From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Sunday saw parliamentary elections in the Asian nation of Myanmar, still called Burma, its former colonial name, in the U.S., U.K., Canada, and Australia. The elections were seen in the West as the first free elections in the country in decades. Thay Hu, the acting chair of Myanmar's ruling Union Solidarity Development Party, conceded defeat to the opposition National League for Democracy, led by the U.S.-backed Aung San Suu Kyi. Although hailed as a victory for democracy by Western media, in geopolitical terms, the vote is seen as a potential extension of U.S. influence over a country that's been closely allied to BRICS members, China and India. The vote was a remarkable comeback for the woman who first won elections held 25 years ago, during the time of the collapse of the Soviet bloc, with which the country's military regime was aligned. But the West's presentation of the election as a victory for democracy was contradicted by the fact that Muslim candidates were barred from taking part in the vote, and members of the country's persecuted Rohingya Muslim minority, who mostly live in the western state of Rakhine, were deprived of the right to vote and, according to Sheikh Firdous, the head of Rohingya Federation of Arakan, suffered a purge from the ranks of Aung San Suu Kyi's Buddhist-majority NLD party.
As far as the result is concerned, it will not bring any specific change for the Rohingyas specifically. The NLD was the first party when the law was passed. They eliminated all the Muslims from her party. So there is no specific or clear stand for the Rohingyas.
Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims have been subject to systematic repression by extremist Buddhists since the country's independence in 1948. Murray Hebert is a senior fellow and deputy director of the Sumitro Chair for Southeast Asia Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Speaking with China's CCTV news agency, he pointed out that Sunday's election was only the beginning of a complex process of forming a government.
You know, ultimately, the elections happen today, but from going forward, we now have the parliamentarians, the lower and upper house, are going to decide on who's the vice president, who they're going to nominate for vice president. There's going to be three nominations, and then they're going to vote on who's going to be president. This horse trading is going to go on between now and probably sometime in February or March. And so, yes, today was seemed very peaceful and a lot of enthusiasm, but we're going to have to see what happens once the numbers come in for the parties and how the horse trading turns out in the end.
Hebert also pointed out some of the contradictions that will face the newly elected parliamentarians as they begin the task of forming a government.
There's an awful lot of opportunities in the horse trading, as I mentioned, to figure out who's the president and in the days ahead. There were people that were not on the voter list. That was a problem. 25% of the parliament is still controlled by the military. They're appointed delegates. That's creating some dissatisfaction. There's a group of nationalist Buddhist monks, Mabata, they're called. They very much called on people to vote for the ruling party against the opposition NLD Aung San Suu Kyi's party. If she does very well, they could well instigate some unrest. So we really, you know, there's a lot of opportunities in the days ahead for things to go off the rails a little bit. I think foreign investors are very much watching to see what's happening. They want to see if this election was stable. They want to see how this turns out. Ultimately, who the president is, what his or her cabinet is, and then decide if this is a good place to invest.
He also addressed what the election results might mean for relations between Myanmar and China.
Aung San Suu Kyi, the opposition leader, has gone to China in the middle of this year. She met President Xi Jinping. They had a good meeting. I think every leader, any leader that's going to be elected, recognizes that China is an important neighbor, they have a very important economic relationship. But I think what's changing is that in the past, under the sanctions from the West, the country only had to rely on China. Now it's trying to broaden its relations, not exclude China, but have good relations with its Southeast Asian neighbors, Japan, Europe, United States.
An apparent attack on an American-run facility in Jordan with American casualties.
The fact that someone dressed in military uniform carried out an attack at a training facility in which it appears that there may have been two or three U.S. citizens killed and a number of other individuals injured. Obviously, a full investigation is taking place. We take this very seriously, and we'll be working closely with the Jordanians to determine exactly what happened.
That was President Barack Obama on Monday while meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after learning that a gunman had opened fire at a U.S.-funded security training facility on the outskirts of the Jordanian capital of Amman, leaving 8 dead and another 6 wounded, according to a spokesperson, Mohammed Momani. The attacker was reportedly a senior co-trainer who had the rank of captain, according to a Jordanian security source. The attack took place at Mwagar Camp, a facility funded by the U.S. for training Iraqi and Palestinian special security forces. The quantity of greenhouse gases accumulating in Earth's atmosphere is increasing more rapidly than had been earlier predicted. According to the World Meteorological Organization, the amount of harmful greenhouse gases in the atmosphere had reached a new record high as of the end of last year. The UN agency's annual greenhouse gas bulletin has been released 3 weeks before the international community gathers in Paris, France, in an attempt to reach a legally binding climate deal. The climate change conference, known as COP21, will aim to keep global temperature rises below 2 degrees Celsius. Daniel Dickinson reports.
The WMO's Greenhouse Gas Bulletin reveals that between 1990 and 2014, there was a 36% increase in radiative forcing. That's the warming effect on our climate. It's due to long-lived greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide, or CO2, methane and nitrous oxide from industrial, agricultural and domestic activities. Michel Jarron is the WMO chief.
About a quarter of the emissions are absorbed by the ocean, another quarter by the biosphere, and about 50% is left in the atmosphere, and is left for very, very long time. What is sent in the atmosphere stays there for literally centuries.
The latest increase continues what the WMO is calling a relentless rise, which is fueling climate change and which will make the planet more dangerous and inhospitable for future generations. According to Michel Jarreau, carbon dioxide is the main culprit.
Over the last decade, CO2 has been responsible for about 83% of the total increase in radiative forcing by all greenhouse gases. So you can see this is the real elephant in the room, and we have no chance to tackle climate change if we don't tackle the emission of CO2.
In Paris in December, world leaders will gather at the COP21 conference to agree a deal which will limit the increase in global temperatures to below 2 degrees Celsius. Already, around 150 countries have submitted plans showing how they intend to cut back on emissions. Oksana Tarasova is from the WMO's research department. She says it's crucial to reach an agreement in order to meet the target.
If we continue with the business as usual and increase the emissions 2% per year from fossil fuel, cement production and land use emissions, then we will hit the threshold of 2 degrees with a probability between 90% and 66% between 10 to 20 years from now.
An increase in global temperatures could have dramatic and long-term effects, including rising sea levels and increase in natural disasters. It could also lead to the spread of disease. WMO chief Michel Jarreau says the time to act is now.
It's important to act quickly, because if we don't act quickly, what we emit will affect the next generation.
The COP21 conference takes place during the first 2 weeks of December. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Last December, Reverend Edward Pinckney, a social and economic justice activist in Benton Harbor, Michigan, was sentenced to serve up to 10 years in prison on the claim that he had altered a few dates on a recall petition against the city's mayor, James Hightower. The recall was prompted by the mayor's continued support for tax relief for the Whirlpool Corporation, the $19 billion Fortune 500 company headquartered in Benton Harbor. The clearly politically motivated prosecution against Pinckney killed the petition to recall Hightower, who many believe would have been ousted had the petition not been dismissed due to the allegations against Reverend Pinckney. Legally, the altering of a petition is a misdemeanor in Michigan. Instead, Reverend Pinckney was charged with felony forgery, although no signatures were forged, and all signatories to the petition testified that they signed willingly and on the correct day. A forensic expert for the prosecution testified that there was no way to determine who changed the handful of dates that were alleged to be changed. Nevertheless, the all-white jury was urged by the prosecutor to believe that direct evidence was not required and that they only had to believe that Pinckney was motivated to cheat and could have changed the dates while circulating the petitions. Reverend Pinckney remains in prison and, in fact, was moved to a prison more than 10 hours away from his home community. Polly Hughes is one of the local activists working on his case, and we spoke with her via Skype Saturday.
Reverend Edward Pinckney was sentenced, as you know, in 2014, December. Since then, he's been to Marquette Prison for a couple months. Then he was placed at Lakeland Correctional Facility in Coldwater, Michigan. He's had two hearings, February and April of this year, during which every brief was denied, from his bond pending his appeal to asking for a mistrial due to a perjured juror. A juror actually blatantly perjured herself on the stand. We proved it, but the judge dismissed it. The ACLU has been involved from day one. Now he's been at Coldwater for several months, Coldwater prison, where he preached sermons. He was helping inmates with legal issues and even family issues. He was receiving visitors every week on visiting days. 3 days a week he could get visitors. He got lots of mail. He called his wife 2 times every day. He was calling activists, and he even regularly called into radio shows. Some in New York, in Chicago, and D.C. He wasn't silent, and he wasn't isolated from his family and his supporters. And it was good because we could keep tabs on his health and his well-being, and we could communicate with him. But even though it was good in those ways, Coldwater was no resort. It was still a prison. It served maggot-infested food and rotten meat, which was served by Aramark Corporation. Inmates got sick every day from the food. The Reverend survived on eating just one meal a day. Plus, he got some packaged food from his wife that she could order from a certain company to be sent to the prison, and then the prison doled out that food to him. Visitors who could go and could take in quarters and buy food from the vending machines for him when they visited him. And this is really what sustained him, the food, the packaged food and the vending machine food. That's what he was living on while he was at Coldwater. You and your audience probably know the Reverend was incarcerated unjustly. He was charged with minor crimes of changing dates on petitions that were turned into felonies. His innocence was really proven in court. There was no evidence against him at all. The judge and the prosecutor wanted to put him away in order for the powerful Whirlpool Corporation that has its headquarters in Benton Harbor to silence him. His attorney has now filed briefs for bond 3 times. They were denied. All of them were denied by the appellate court and the Supreme Court, Michigan. Now his appeal brief has been filed with the Michigan Appellate Court. So things were going, you know, as smoothly as we could probably expect them to go until October 6th. And that's when Pinckney was transferred abruptly from Lakeland, which is about 90 miles from his Benton Harbor home, to Marquette Prison, which is in the Upper Peninsula. And that's almost 500 miles from his home. Pinckney and his family, his legal counsel, nobody was given prior notification of his being transferred. In fact, somebody had visited him just on that Monday before, and he never said a word about it. Somebody visited him on Saturday before, and he there was nothing. So he wasn't notified. He was just at midnight, they came into his cell, told him pack up, and at 4 a.m., they started the two-day trip to Marquette. Nobody knew where he was for about 48 hours. Then on Friday, the 23rd of October, the Reverend called his wife, Dorothy, in the morning. See, he gave her two calls every day. But by the afternoon, she got no call, and she finally learned that his phone privileges had been revoked. She knew nothing. She just knew that he couldn't use the phone anymore. Now, what's really is something that we have a lot of information of what has happened since the 23rd for about a week after that, because a Michigan supporter decided he was going to go visit him. And he traveled the 9-10 hours it took to visit Pinckney at the end of October, about the 30th and 31st. And we have learned some really devastating things because of those two evenings with the Reverend that he spent, totaled about 5 hours. And from our calls, activist calls to the Michigan Department of Corrections, which we started to do immediately when he was transferred and then when his phone was taken away. First of all, the transfer to Marquette was definitely rushed. We know that. But Reverend Pinckney saw the document, the order for the transfer, and expedite was stamped on the top in large red bold letters. So since individuals have been calling the MDOC and the prison, we've been told several reasons. Mostly that it's for his safety, that he was moved for his safety, which is, of course, not a good reason. He felt relatively safe in cold water. And Marquette actually has a reputation for not being safe. But another reason given was that he had to be returned to Marquette because his hearings are over. Well, his last hearing was in April, 6 months ago. But I was told the same thing. When I questioned the logic that they gave me, you know, they said MDOC actually returned one of my calls, and they have returned a few other people's calls too. And they said, well, his hearings are over, so we had to get him back to Marquette. So, but that was 6 months ago. Then I was told, well, a bed was open in Marquette, and he had to go there because the bed was open. And I responded, well, he had a bed in Coldwater for months. Well, then they came back. Prisoners, a lot of them don't want to be in the UP, but somebody has to be there. So it just went on, and we're getting that run around, different reasons for moving him. We, of course, realize they want to isolate. We feel that they want to isolate him and silence him. So he feels really unsafe. He told this visitor, four prisoners were killed in September. One of them was tasered by a guard and died. Three others were killed in prisoner fights. And the prison administration just seems to have a divide and conquer strategy with inmates. They tolerate, they might even encourage fights. The guards are unarmed, except they must have tasers. They don't intervene quickly to halt fights. And there are some gangs formed within the Marquette prison. And this all came from Pinckney to this visitor. We want Reverend Pinckney to be returned to Lakeland or to a prison closer to home. Obviously, he's in the UP. Pretty soon, the weather's going to get very rough, and people won't be able to go and see him. Even now, it's difficult because it's a very long drive from the Michigan area, Detroit or Benton Harbor or Lansing area, 9-10 hours at least.
For our listeners, the UP that she's referring to is the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And in terms of the weather, if you look at a map, it's practically the Canadian heartland.
I'm 6 hours away. I could visit him, but They're creating some problems there, too. I was on the visitor list. He deactivated me in the fall. I visited him in June. He deactivated me so other people could get on his list. And you can only have 10. They can have 10 visitors plus family on the list at one time. And I kept calling the prison saying, asking them, am I activated? And they would tell me, well, Pinckney just has to tell his counselor to activate you. And as soon as we get at the front desk, you're good to come and see him. Finally, the MDOC called me and said, you can't be on his list until March because he made changes in September and he can only make changes every 6 months.
Oh, brother.
So I'm the closest. Unfortunately, I'm about 6 hours away, but I probably won't, I will have to wait till spring if he's still there to go at the time to see him. So we really, everything just leads up to for us to have that conclusion that they really don't want him to have visitors. They don't want him to talk to people. They don't want him to communicate. They want to isolate him. But at any rate, he did waive his right for level one security so he could be moved to Lakeland, which is a level two. But he felt much safer at Lakeland. He spent a couple months, maybe not quite 2 months, up in Marquette when he first was incarcerated. That's where they took him immediately in December. And he knew when he got to Marquette, he pretty much knew what he was in for. Now he rarely leaves his cell except for orders, such as mealtime. They have to go, even if they're not going to eat, and he probably is eating apparently just one meal or picking through what he can get. Because they have vending machines there, but not much but snacks and sodas.
Yeah, just for some people have an
appreciation. He'll leave a cell if he has to.
Hang on 1 second. I just want people to have an appreciation for prison food. And we're talking, if you go back, sort of a Saga Foods meets Alpo in terms of the quality of the food and the quality control at best.
Well, yes. Aramark, who lost their contract recently with the prison in Michigan, was serving food that was just tainted. It was scooped up off the floor and served to the inmates. It had maggots in it. It had. He told us on one show he called in, he said, my mashed potatoes had rocks in them.
Oh, no.
And inmates would get sick every day. They'd go to the infirmary, and they'd pay $5 to see a nurse, and she'd give them an aspirin. And they'd have food poisoning, or they'd be just sick from what they had eaten. So, yeah, the food situation is very... Prison is...
No picnic.
Nothing, no picnic, yeah. It's not a good place. Certainly not for an innocent man, for sure. So he'd been walking quite a few miles a day at Lakeland. When I visited him in June, he told me how he'd walk around the track, and he had a couple prisoners that he, trust he was close with, and he walked, made sure he walked with them. But now at Marquette, he's not getting, much exercise, if any. Then the phone cut off. This is really the most, probably most devastating piece of this right now, because we can't communicate with him. His service was cut off with no hearing. He just received tickets. They give you tickets for any infractions. So some of the charges we know that he's been charged with are soliciting over the phone, fundraising over the phone, three-way calls through his home phone. And then they even gave him a ticket accusing him of stealing one of those little pocket rule books. This book was lent to him by a guard at Marquette, and then another guard saw him with it and accused him of stealing the book. And apparently the guard who let him use it didn't step up to the plate and defend him. So that's kind of sounds like a setup to me.
Yeah, or if he gave it to him, surreptitiously, he's not going to stand up and say, yeah, I violated the rules. It wasn't me, it was him.
He was violating a rule, that might be.
Yeah.
So Reverend Pena denies the phone charges. He's contested the charges. He's asked for a proper hearing. And at the hearing, the prison supposedly will determine whether Pinckney knew the infractions were being committed. They have recordings of the calls in question. And if they find him guilty, and we feel they probably will, his phone privileges could be revoked for up to 6 months.
Wow. Incommunicado.
That's a long time, yeah.
And meanwhile,
we've learned from the visitor that he's enduring a lot of harassment. It's being targeted directly to him. Now, apparently, when you get mail, when an inmate gets mail from his lawyer, it's not supposed to be opened until it reaches the inmate. And then they can open it in front of him. He has to read it. They read it. But it's illegal to open it first. And he's getting mail that's been opened before it even reaches him. So, yes, we know they look at all of his mail. But apparently there's a procedure and process that they are not following. Which brings the question, is he getting all of his mail? You know, he wonders. Of course, you have to be a little careful when you do write to him and not give them anything that the prison would want to know or wouldn't want to keep from him. But the mail is in question. He also was recommended to conduct church services, which he did at Lakeland. He preached several sermons. He'd have 100-150 inmates come to his sermons. So a fellow prisoner recommended this. It was okayed, and then suddenly the assignment was withdrawn before he had a chance to even give one sermon. Pinckney also told the visitor that the guards are telling fellow inmates that Pinckney's a scammer and he can't be trusted, to stay away from him. Well, of course, we know Reverend Pinckney, and we know he befriends people easily. Right. He's trustworthy. In fact, he's really a model prisoner. Yeah. He doesn't cause any problems. And at the Lakeland prison, a statement was overheard before he was moved, and the statement was, he doesn't give us any trouble, but they must really, really hate him. Yeah. So, of course, we think us is obviously the Lakeland staff, and we're surmising that they are connected somehow to Berrien County, to the officials,
the boss.
The boss, yeah, whoever, the Whirlpool Corporation or whoever's in charge. Mm. So that's disturbing. He also, in the visitation room, he told Jim, the visitor, that all the clothing that he has was on his back. That there he had two sets. One set was sent to the laundry several days ago, was never returned to him. So he had one set of clothes, a pair of shorts, some long underwear, and one blue short sleeve uniform to wear. And it's going to get cold, and they don't exactly keep the prisons warm. So that's, you know, all these little things are irritants, but some are harassment. But one of the worst things is, when he first got to Marquette, he was put in a bullpen-type location, and the walls had this extensive black mold all over them. It made him very ill. He got dizzy. He couldn't eat. He had trouble breathing. He's diabetic also, so there's a health issue involved. And Pinckney believes that our calls, we started making calls to the Michigan Department of Corrections right away, protesting the move to begin with. And he really thinks that after over a few days, and I think he might have been in this area for close to a week, that he was finally moved to a better location, but there's still mold on the walls. So Marquette, apparently the sanitary conditions aren't good. And on the 13th of October, the Reverend called me and he told me over the phone that he was finally that day able to eat. And he felt a little physically better, like he was starting to not have quite the same stomach aches and the dizziness. So I'm not sure how long he was in that first area, but it certainly affected his health. And then on Friday night, now when the visitor went to Marquette, he visisited on Friday for 2 hours. It's a 3 hour span of visiting time only. He stayed overnight. He visited him on Saturday evening also. But on Friday, Pinckney told the visitor that they were calling out his name over the PA system as many as 20 times a day. And they would tell him to come to a certain area. And he would do that, so he'd respond. You know, he was ordered to go to so-and-so place. He'd get there, and the guard would say to him, never mind, you can go back to your cell. So up to 20 times a day, over a span of two or three weeks, he's been just being run around. Now, when Jim went back on Saturday to see Reverend Pinckney, the Reverend told him that the PA system calls had stopped. So this was Friday night, he told him, and then Saturday during the day, none of that happened. We don't know if that was a temporary easement of it, or did it pick up again.
Okay, so where are things at right now, and what should people be doing?
Anybody can go to the bhbanco.org website, and you'll find the addresses, and you'll find some articles You'll find scripts you can use. So it's Benton Harbor, BHBANCO.org is a great one just to start with, and you'll find more information there.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.